Accession number 2609, reel 2.
Once a hand had been found floating in a reservoir, a tank of water situated in the camp for firefighting, but nobody ever solved the mystery, neither a body, handless or otherwise, nor the identity of the hand was ever discovered. Camp concerts were always in rehearsal somewhere, and one of the barracks, 29A, was used as a concert hall. Shakespeare, classics, variety, Christmas pantomimes, with Denholm Elliott and Clive Dunn performing all throughout the year. Also choral performances of Gilbert and Sullivan, like Merry England, the Mikado, as well as performances by the Stalag Orchestra. The Stalag School thrived, with students taking exams with papers sent from England and taken under strict supervision by the tutors. I had an exhibition of many of my Stalag paintings and drawings. The highlight was my portrait of a Canadian captured at Dieppe, a tall, gaunt-faced and bearded commando who was explaining the action with his hands in chains. Chains had replaced the Red Cross string. The Jerry had discovered the ruse of comrades untying their friends and were now using chains on the wrists, about 12 inches in length. They didn't realise they were being unlocked again with sardine tin openers. Boredom, frustration, living in a world apart, these were the daily ingredients for us, and every device was used by human ingenuity to create diversions and mental escape. Books were always exchanged, and men would wander from compound to compound with a book in hand, seeking an exchange. The unvarying German diet of one loaf between five or seven men, a scrap of margarine, a small piece of sausage once a week, cabbage, Swede soup or sauerkraut continued, and sometimes Han cheese, usually described as stinking cheese. We received Red Cross parcels, two men per parcel, once a week, except when there was an escape, when they were stopped as a punishment. For the whole camp of 12,000 was normal if a prisoner had disobeyed a guard or behaved improperly in any way to the Germans. When Group Captain Bader was transferred to the camp, he was the legless pilot who was shot down over Berlin. He was with us a few days when he was sweeping the road with a broom, and a working party had been searched before proceeding to the factory. As they marched out of camp between the second and third fence, they passed Bader, who gave the broom to a marcher, and stepped in his place and marched out of camp. He was soon missed, and when the marking party arrived at the factory, everyone was ordered to drop their trousers. He couldn't hide his wooden legs. We went without parcels for 2 weeks. The first repatriation exchange began in late 1943, and badly wounded sick personnel with some medical corps were exchanged. I was among others to staff the camp hospital, and I was working as a nurse for many months, during which the Italians were fighting the invasion, and the Germans transferred all the Italian prisoners and wounded to Germany. One notable hospital train that came to us was one that, passing through the Brenner Pass, had been bombed and machine-gunned by Jerry planes. I still correspond with one of my old patients, Reg Bartholomew, who had to have his leg amputated. The big Russian offensive for Christmas 1944 began a nightmare of waiting to be rescued. As the German army retreated, we heard the barrage of heavy guns day and night. We expected the Russians to march up the road every day, but nothing happened day after day. Finally, in February, the evacuation of Camp Stalag 8B and our hospital was ordered, and the Camp Kriegers began to march west. Several escaped, but the bitter weather with snow inches deep and with little food made the going very difficult. Our walking patients were sent with them, and the staff of our hospital accompanied us. Same routine of cattle trucks, this time with our stretcher patients too, resumed and continued for 4 days through Germany in bitter snow-covered country. Finally, the train halted for longer than usual, and we were all marched through small villages for hours till we reached a camp on the outskirts of Memmingen, south of Munich. Memmingen had a large railway junction, which in March was attacked by a large force of American bombers. Fortunately, we were spectators, and only afterwards the full horror of it struck us when we marched into the town. We were sent in squads to rescue the injured and trapped in the bombed houses. We were grateful to have our German guards for protection as we marched through the town amidst the shocked, angry and sorrowing people. It became evident as the days passed that our liberation was not far off. Large Red Cross flags were flown at the corners of the camp, and the guards became very friendly and more scarce. Distant gunfire became nearer every hour, and soon the staff who were in the building housing our patients were straining their eyes looking for signs of our liberators. Rumours changed minute by minute. They have seen the tanks. They've seen smoke. A white flag was seen hanging from the town church. The memorable day came on April 26th. Mid-morning, the camp lit up with electric excitement as tanks were seen approaching. Everyone surged to the main gate, shaking and laughing with disbelief. We were all jammed up against the main gates as more and more prisoners pressed forward. Some clambered over the top, heedless of the barbed wire, as a tank with the American flag moving slowly towards us. The gate remained closed. Where the key or lock was, no one knew. But suddenly the gate burst open and the dense, cheering crowd poured out to the tank, which was now stopped. An officer stood in the turret firing his pistol. The shot quietened our laughter and wild cheers. "Nice to see you," the officer drawled. "But don't go down into the town yet. It could be quite dangerous." We did go down to the town later on when the military police were on patrol. 3 weeks later, Dakota American airplanes flew us to Rouen, and the next day, in a Wellington bomber, we flew over the white cliffs of Dover.